And thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad when you join us here. And if you'd like to take part in our conversations on the exchange, you're more than welcome to do that. Phone numbers are as follows, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Seems like every time there's a shocking news story about a crime allegedly committed by a young person, we soon hear the phrase, "will be tried as an adult." But there are efforts underway across the country to keep younger offenders generally out of the adult justice system. And the efforts are tracked in a recently released report. It is titled State Trends, Legislative Victories from 2011 to 2013, Removing Youth from the Adult Criminal Justice System. The report lays out the changes occurring in various states, including in California and Oregon, and the rationales for those changes. Carmen Daugherty is the report author and the policy director of the Campaign for Youth Justice and one of our guests here on the exchange today. Carmen, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
It's good to have you here. Shannon White, WIGHT, is the deputy director at the Partnership for Safety and Justice. Shannon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's talk about each of your organizations in turn, if you would. Shannon, let's start with you about the Partnership for Safety and Justice and what you represent.
Yeah, Partnership for Safety and Justice is based here in Oregon. We're a statewide advocacy organization that's fighting for a smarter public safety system. Part of what's really unique about what we do is that we look at it from both the perspective of people who get convicted of crime, like the youth we're talking about today, but also victims of crime. We think our system needs to be serving everyone well who ends up moving through it. So we are based here in Portland, but are a statewide advocacy organization.
Right. So not just youth and not just the focus on the justice system for criminals.
Exactly.
All right. And so let's talk to you, Carmen Daugherty, about what goes on at the Campaign for Youth Justice.
Sure. The Campaign for Youth Justice is a national organization that partners with parents, youth and families, and advocates across the country to reform transfer laws that send youth to the adult system.
And so give us the general movement in attitudes, if you would, about children in the justice system, because it does seem like certainly there was a spate of years there when it seemed like every time there was some heinous crime, it's like, oh, so-and-so will be tried as an adult. That is generally still the exception. Is that true?
Well, sure. So what we've seen, approximately 250,000 youth under 18 are tried, sentenced, and incarcerated as adults each year across the country. But what we've seen in the last 8 years, we've seen nearly half of the states, 23 states, enacting approximately 40 pieces of legislation to remove youth from the adult criminal justice system.
And Shannon, what are the trends in Oregon that you've been able to track through your work?
Well, the work that we've focused on here in Oregon has really looked at where youth are held when they're charged as adults. And so the legislation that's passed in the last few years in 2011 and 2013 have really gone to address keeping youth out of adult jails and out of adult prison in Oregon.
Has it been a bit of a pendulum? I mean, was there a time when there was a greater emphasis on making sure that people were punished younger and more seriously, more like adults when they were younger?
Absolutely. The 90s, you know, we keep hearing the term, or we heard the term super predator, where, you know, we kept hearing legislators and politicians say kids who commit adult crime should get adult time. And now that more time has passed, we see that that's not a very effective practice as far as reducing recidivism or reducing crime.
Let's go right to the recidivism issue, because I noticed, having read the report, and again, it's called Legislative Victories from 2011 to 2013, Removing Youth from the Adult Criminal Justice System. What is the general difference in recidivism rate, Carmen, between adults and juveniles?
Well, we know that kids who are in the adult criminal justice system are 34 times more likely to recidivate than their counterparts in the juvenile detention facilities and juvenile justice system. And this is huge, and we know that they recidivate at a faster rate and sometimes at a more violent level when they're in the adult criminal justice system.
34 more times, more likely to commit crimes again.
Yes.
Interesting. And if there are 34 more times if they're in the adult criminal justice system, anybody track the what are some of the specifics that lead into those numbers, why that happens?
I mean, we just know that the adult system is not one to be rehabilitative. We know it's more punitive than most juvenile justice systems across the country. And we know not every juvenile justice system is perfect. However, we hope that by, you know, keeping more kids in the juvenile side, it will give them more opportunities at educational opportunities and also just programming to help them reenter society once they've served their time.
Carmen Daugherty, there was a similar report several years ago. Is it a regular updating that goes on at the Campaign for Youth Justice, or have there been big changes to document and that's why the report emerged again?
Well, I just felt like at this time, so many changes have happened in the last 8 years that we had to document it and show the good work of the advocates like Shannon to say, you know, this isn't unique. States are doing this. States realize that it's a better cost benefit to keep kids on the juvenile side. And it's surprising to see that these changes happened all over the country in bipartisan legislatures and passed by a bipartisan group of governors.
Much more to talk about with our guests. We're talking about juvenile justice and where it should take place, whether children should be tried in strictly a juvenile system, in what circumstances they might be tried as adults, and where they should be held while they're awaiting trial. Join us back on the Jefferson Exchange with Carmen Daugherty and Shannon White. We'll return with them and take your phone calls and emails when we return from this break in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our topic today is criminal justice, particularly as it relates to young people, youthful offenders, juvenile offenders, children committing crimes. Use whichever term feels most comfortable to you. The question these days is, where are they most appropriately given their dose of justice? Because the trend now seems to be moving away from providing justice for juveniles in the adult criminal justice system. And we're looking at the findings of a report called State Trends, Legislative Victories from 2011 to 2013, Removing Youth from the Adult Criminal Justice System. Carmen Daugherty wrote the report. She's the policy director at the Campaign for Youth Justice. Shannon White is the deputy director of the Partnership for Safety and Justice in Oregon. And you can join this conversation on the exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Shannon White, I want to come to you because your focus is broader than just juvenile justice and does include some consideration for victims as well. Tell me about then the issues with trying to get justice both for offender and for victim, and whether there's any sense of vengeance that comes along with trying to make to push for youthful offenders to get tried as adults or kept in adult lockups.
You know, I certainly think that can be the case where people who have been harmed by crime are looking for very harsh prosecution. And that was a trend that Carmen referred to back in the 90s when there was this whole kind of tough-on-crime movement, and it was really focused on those people and victims that have been harmed and their call for vengeance. I think we're learning increasingly that there are a range of ways and types of people that get victimized, and they have a range of different responses. Oftentimes, youth crime, crime in general, happens against someone you know or a family member. And oftentimes, what people want most is a resolution where that person is less likely to come out and commit another crime. And I do think there is a common sense understanding that putting youth into the adult system, into adult jails and prisons, doesn't get us good long-term public safety outcomes. So we have had support across the board in our work for doing something about reforming our mandatory transfer laws in Oregon that cause youth to be tried automatically as adults and subjects them to adult jails and sometimes prison.
That was a compound phrase you laid out there, which is they don't want people to come out and commit another crime. Now, if they come out and don't commit another crime, that's a different story.
Well, exactly, and I think that's why the trend is going the way it is now. And now, rather than having tough on crime, we have smart on crime is a phrase that's been used. There is a conservative group called Right on Crime that starts looking at smarter ways to do public safety policy. I think we've realized that incarcerating our way out of crime isn't going to work, and it isn't cost effective, and particularly when it comes to young people, that hasn't been a good trend for us. We know a lot more than we did back in the 90s when these laws were passed across the country. We know more about youth brain development and how they are more amenable to treatment. We know which programs work and don't work for youth. And we know, like Carmen said, that youth are 34 times more likely to commit a new crime when they end up in the adult system than youth who are similarly placed in the juvenile system. So those are the kinds of things that I think are causing an impetus for change across the country and are helping to move changes here in Oregon.
So, Carmen, when Shannon says they're more amenable to rehabilitation, how good is the rate of rehabilitation for youthful offenders?
Well, I would just add that I think a lot of people don't realize that a huge percentage of these kids who are in the adult system end up on adult probation, where they're receiving no services. Maybe they'll check in with a probation officer once or twice a week, but other than that, they're not learning positive behavior. So they're just, more likely to reoffend and commit a crime at a faster and a more violent rate. So I think, the juvenile justice system, and like I said before, not all systems are perfect across the country, but they at least afford the opportunity for these kids to receive either positive behavior, programming, education, or just opportunities in reading and writing workshops that really help and make sense align with their brain development and adolescent development.
Is there a snapshot of the youthful offender that is necessary, a fairly typical age and income level, of family and education level?
We don't have a national snapshot of that. Unfortunately, there is no national data that captures kids in the adult system. Only 13 states currently provide that information at a national level. We know that each state has a different way of doing things because it is a local issue. However, of the 13 states that do provide that information about their transfer rates, we do know that Florida has the highest rate of transfer and transfers kids at 8 times the rate of California.
All right. If we talk about transfer, Shannon, I want to come to you because you mentioned Oregon's mandatory transfer law and how that's been changed. When we talk about transfer, we're talking about transferring into the adult system from the juvenile system?
That's right. And in Oregon, that happens as a result of Ballot Measure 11, which was passed in 1994 by the voters. And what it did was create mandatory sentences both for youth and adults. So the same sentence, if you are 15 years old and commit robbery or 35-year-old, you get the same mandatory minimum sentence. And the other thing it did, though, specifically for 15 and 16 and 17-year-olds, is create that automatic transfer. So those youth, when they're charged with any of the offenses that were outlined in Measure 11, automatically transfer into the adult criminal justice system and then, again, are subjected to the same mandatory minimum sentences that an adult would be, and they are also prosecuted in the adult court, are at risk of being held in adult jail pretrial as they're awaiting sentence.
The Measure 11 offenses were all person offenses, weren't they? Murder, rape, assault, kidnap, along those lines?
Yeah, they are person offenses. I do think, those high, rape, murder gets talked about a lot. Some of the lower level offenses, like robbery and assault, we found anecdotally we hear a lot of stories from families and from judges that some of those are the kinds of crimes that really don't need to be prosecuted in the adults because they just aren't serious. There's a wide range of behavior that can be prosecuted under an assault, too. And we know, Carmen was alluding to or referencing the fact that a lot of these youth end up on probation. We did a report and a study with the Campaign for Youth Justice in 2011, and our findings found that in Oregon, 36% of youth who got indicted for one of these adult offenses ended up on probation. And so it does beg the question one, as Carmen pointed out, they're not getting services, but also do we want to saddle those youth with an adult felony conviction, which is a huge barrier to employment and housing, the kinds of things people need to be successful, if their offense is less serious enough that the prosecutors are agreeing to a probation sentence.
So potentially you're stamped at age 17 as a convict.
Or 15 or 16, mm-hmm. and it will carry with you for life. And every time you try and get a job or get housing, which we know are just key parts of people living crime-free lives, they've got this on them and no chance of doing anything about that conviction.
And so what Oregon has since passed the Safe Kids, Safer Communities law, is that right?
Right.
And what does that do?
And that was really focused on this piece where youth get detained in adult jail pre-conviction, right? So they get arrested, and then once they're indicted for one of these Measure 11 offenses, they can be held in adult jail. The law we passed tried to change that. We've started the process of moving it and are currently doing a survey of every county right now to determine which counties have gone ahead and changed their practice so that they're keeping youth in safer juvenile facilities rather than adult facilities, where often, and I think this was alluded to in the report, state trends, that youth, when they're held in adult jails, at least here in Oregon, what we found is that the sheriffs know that the youth aren't safe in their facilities, and so they hold them in isolation cells, particularly for youth who have any mental health issues. That can be a very dangerous place for youth to be, and greatly increases their likelihood of attempted suicide or suicide. So we are working to keep those youth out of adult jails pre-trial before they're even convicted of a crime.
Is there any indication of whether the isolation is any worse for them than being in the general population in the jail? Or is the point just to keep them out of the adult jail, period?
Yes, I think that—sorry, go ahead, Carmen.
No, go ahead. I will offer a national perspective on that. Now we have this federal Prison Rape Elimination Act, a youthful inmate standard, which says state facilities, jails, prisons, lockups have to sight and sound separate kids under 18 from adults, and they can't use isolation as a method of doing so. And as Shannon was saying, we know that the use of isolation exacerbates mental health disorders. We work with many families across the country where their kids have committed suicide while in administrative segregation. So it just begs the question, are they any safer separated? And that's a tough one.
We're talking about juveniles in the adult prison system here on the Jefferson Exchange. Two guests with us, Carmen Daugherty, who you just heard is the report author of State Trends, Legislative Victories from 2011 to 2013, Removing Youth from the Adult Criminal Justice System. Carmen is the policy director at the Campaign for Youth Justice, a nationwide group. Shannon White joins us as well. She's deputy director of the Partnership for Safety and Justice based in Portland. You can join this discussion about the appropriate placement of children who have committed crimes and are awaiting trial and are waiting for or have been sentenced post-trial. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you said you've been, you're at this point surveying the various counties, Shannon, across Oregon to find out if they're actually segregating the youthful offenders out of the adult jail population awaiting trial?
Yeah, well, I mean, what we're trying to determine is whether or not counties are figuring out how to keep youth in juvenile detention facilities pretrial rather than in the adult jails. Part of the problem with implementation of that Safe Kids, Safe Communities Act is that we don't have a juvenile detention facility in every county in Oregon. We only have 12 juvenile detention facilities, so counties have to figure out, getting those youth to some of the counties where they have safe spaces for them. I think that the problem with you would ask the question about keeping youth in the general population in adult jail, that's when we know that young people are really vulnerable to physical and sexual violence, and law enforcement knows that as well, and it's why they put them in isolation. But as Carmen pointed out, that leads to the potential for these attempted and completed suicides, and so it's a real challenge. But I think the people in Oregon, both at the juvenile and sheriff's departments, are working to find solutions.
Well, and then you've answered part of the question already about what if there is no juvenile detention center in the county, and with 12 in Oregon, there's obviously 24 counties that don't have them. I know Josephine County had a pretty well-regarded juvenile facility that it's since had to close for money reasons. So what happens? I mean, in Josephine County's case, I believe they actually rent some bed space in Jackson County, but at some point that might fill up too. What happens then?
Well, I mean, all the counties that don't have juvenile detention space have to rent from another county, and sometimes actually another state. People rent in Idaho, California, and Washington, because when youth aren't charged as adults, they certainly can't be in an adult jail. So we either have to figure out how to have them released pretrial, which is always an option if these youth are safe to be home, which most of them are. That's a very real option, is just to keep them on what they call pretrial release. You can be at home, you're reporting to an officer, and you show up for court when you're supposed to, and most kids are safe to do that. But otherwise, every county is already contracting with some other juvenile detention, one of the juvenile detention centers, or some of them out of state for their juveniles who are being held.
Carmen Daugherty, the report that you wrote, again, State Trends, Legislative Victories from 2011 to 2013, Removing Youth from the Adult Criminal Justice System. The report lays out four general trends going on across the country. What are those trends, then, in ways that laws are changing to get the youthful offenders out of the adult criminal justice system?
Sure. So the four that we have been tracking are, one, states that have passed laws limiting states' authority to house youth in adult jails and prisons. Two, states that have expanded their juvenile court jurisdiction so that older youth who previously would have been automatically tried as adults are not necessarily prosecuted in adult criminal court. We call those states the raise-the-age states. As you may know, we have some states that still see all 16-year-olds as adults, like New York and North Carolina. If you're 16, you're automatically prosecuted as adult. And our third trend is states that have changed their transfer laws, making it more likely that youth will stay in the juvenile justice system. And finally, we have been tracking states that have changed their sentencing schemes, whether it's mandatory minimum sentencing laws that have changed, or looking at juvenile life without parole sentencing schemes that have changed since the Miller decision came out in 2012.
Before we get to the Miller decision, trend four then includes California, I see, which passed Senate Bill 9 about a year ago concerning juvenile life without parole. How common is juvenile life without parole?
It's not as common as the transfer rate, obviously. However, it affects, you know, at least, I guess, you know, 2,000 kids right now are housed across the country as juvenile life without parolers.
All right. So, what was the change that happened in California with the passage of Senate Bill 9?
Well, since the Miller decision, states had to reexamine their sentencing schemes around juvenile life without parole. Unfortunately, Miller didn't go to the extent of saying, you know, you cannot do juvenile life without parole. But now states have to kind of reexamine how they're sentencing people under that. So for California, SB 9, introduced by Senator Yee, was enacted in 2012, and it allows for most offenders under the age of 18 at the time of the offense to petition the court to hold a new sentencing hearing after serving 15 years of the original sentence.
That's an interesting concept to think about, though. Somebody who commits a crime when they're 15, 16, 17 years old, though, and they have to ask for different treatment after 15 years. But so they're serving time as adults for crimes they committed as children, which I guess is the main point of your organization.
That's right. And a lot of these sentencing schemes, they don't take into account, you know, maturity. And, you know, a crime committed at 15, you look back 15 years from that point. I mean, I can imagine me as a 16-year-old and the mistakes that I made and being sentenced for the rest of my life for that mistakes after going through growth and maturity and learning a lot more about life. I mean, I think that's a tough pill to swallow for a lot of these kids. And we know that, you know, that sentence is disproportionately applied in California. We call it JLWAP. Kids in California were 85% children of color. So we're talking about African American and Hispanic youth making up that huge percentage of kids sentenced to juvenile life without parole in California.
Let's get to the specifics of the Miller case, as you keep referring to. Miller versus Alabama. Who was suing who there? Well, obviously Miller was suing Alabama, but what was the circumstance of the case?
Sure. So basically this was a reckless manslaughter case. The Supreme Court found that a mandatory sentence of life without possibility of parole is unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment Cruel and Unusual Punishment Amendment. And they said that's cruel and unusual when applied to those under 18. And this, and Miller was just one more decision that has come out of the Supreme Court that says kids are different, and we should be looking at, you know, the brain development, adolescent behavior. And they said over and over again that kids are vulnerable to peer pressure and less able to avoid negative environments, and like Shannon said, more amenable to rehabilitation than adults. And so they said states really need to reexamine this, and their punishments should be graduated and proportioned.
All right, much more to talk about on the whole issue of juveniles in the adult prison system. Obviously, their efforts underfoot across the country, underway across the country, afoot, to make sure that we don't put as many young offenders into the adult criminal justice system. You've been hearing the rationale for that. We'll hear more from Carmen Daugherty, who wrote this report and is the policy director at the Campaign for Youth Justice. Shannon White is the deputy director at the Oregon-based Partnership for Safety and Justice. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Shannon and Carmen and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about juveniles in the adult prison system and efforts underway across the country to make sure that youth are kept in youth facilities, both awaiting trial and once sentenced, rather than being kept in the adult criminal justice system for reasons that it appears they actually are more prone to be recidivists if they are kept in the adult criminal justice system rather than the youth one. Join us on the Exchange as we talk to Carmen Daugherty at the Campaign for Youth Justice and Shannon White at the Partnership for Safety and Justice, 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about what's called JLWAP, Juvenile Life Without Parole in California. Carmen, this year in California, they set up, I understand, youth offender parole hearings under law.
That's right. So California has been very busy. So just in 2013, the California Fair Sentencing for Youth Coalition drafted a bill to address not only juvenile life without parole cases, but basically anybody under the age of 18 at the time of the crime, giving them an opportunity to have a parole hearing and to give great weight to, you know, what, quote unquote, the diminished culpability of juveniles as compared to adults.
So it seems like there, I mean, one of the bases of this report would appear to be that there are vast differences from state to state, that in one state in the country, if you're 16 and commit a crime, a pretty bad one, and end up in the system, your prospects are very different from one state to another.
Absolutely. And, you know, the reason we did this report is to encourage state legislatures and policymakers and advocates to learn from these other states and see what is possible, because there is such a vast difference across the country about how kids enter the system and how they're sentenced. So we thought it would be important to document this and see what's happening across the country.
So in the case of California, in particular with youth offender parole hearings and Senate Bill 9 concerning juvenile life without parole, are there additional costs within the justice system incurred by the passage of these laws?
Well, it's interesting. It's not known yet what SB 260, that's the parole hearing one, will do, but they estimate that it'll affect approximately 5,000 people currently in state prisons in California, and those will benefit from the new law. The question that we get from many state legislatures is, how much will this cost us? And that's, you know, we kind of beg the question, well, how much will it cost you not to do this? So knowing that these kids will have lifelong collateral consequences from adult convictions, like Shannon said, they won't be able to get some public housing in some states, apply for certain financial aid for colleges. So it's really looking at the long game as opposed to just this immediate cost. And that's what we encourage states to do.
Shannon, we talked about Oregon Safe Kids, Safer Communities law. That's not the same thing as House Bill 3183, is it?
No, that's House Bill 3183
is trying to keep youth out of adult prisons. We, by and large, Oregon actually doesn't put youth under the age of 18 in adult prison, but youth who get charged as adults do end up going through an intake at the adult intake facility at Coffee Creek, where they were being held for about a week in isolation. And House Bill 3183 made it possible for us to switch our systems and have those youth go directly to the Oregon Youth Authority, where youth, even youth charged as adults, are allowed to stay as long as their behavior comports with what the Oregon Youth Authority thinks is acceptable in their facility up until their 25th birthday. If their sentence goes past their 25th birthday, then they would be transferred to the adult system. So this was an attempt. There was a place where youth were ending up, another place where youth were ending up in adult prisons, and usually in isolation. And we were hearing from our members and impacted people that this was a problem. And so House Bill 3183 is working to address that.
So I'll ask the same question I asked about the changes in California law. Are there any particular costs incurred, dollar costs to the people from changing the system around?
I mean, that one, I don't think, no. You know, the other bill that we talked about, keeping youth out of adult jails, can potentially have an upfront cost because, you know, when youth are in juvenile detention facilities, they actually get education. They might get addiction treatment, depending on the facility, if they have it, or mental health interventions, where that wouldn't be happening in the adult facility. So juvenile facilities are often more costly up front, but when you consider the fact that those are the kinds of interventions that kids need and tools they need to succeed, I think, as Carmen was talking about, the long-term payoff is much better, and I think that's how we're sort of moving from a tough-on-crime approach to a smart-on-crime approach. If we invest in these young people who've made some bad choices early, we can help them make better choices in the future, and that is both good for the kids and good for our communities and for their victims and survivors, if there are any in their cases.
We have an email from Scott in Ashland. He says, I understand that housing juvenile offenders in adult jails pretrial can pose serious risks to youths. Are there also risks posed when violent juvenile offenders who are charged as adults are housed in juvenile facilities with less serious offenders? In this area, and he's talking about the Oregon Youth Authority facility in Grants Pass, we recently had a riot at a juvenile facility that required, according to press reports, two SWAT teams to quell. I wonder if the security of juvenile facilities is adequate for some of those who are detained there. Again, that from Scott in Ashland. Shannon, can you take that one on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always a question, but I don't think that's necessarily broken down by age of who's going to be the potential biggest safety risk in a facility. I have heard anecdotally when I visited Oregon Youth Authority prisons that actually it's some of these older youth who end up staying there on these longer sentences who become mentors to younger youth and help create a sense of calm within the facility, and that the younger juvenile population can be more rambunctious. So I don't think it's a clear-cut question, and that decision has to be made on an individual basis. I don't know the exact circumstances of what happened at that facility. Clearly something terrible happened, but I don't think those kind of anecdotal stories should be used to kind of indict a whole system that I think overall is actually working better for everyone.
Well, let's take go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to add, I've been in contact with the folks from Multnomah County, and their rate of incidences have actually gone down since they've incorporated Kids Tried as Adults into their facilities.
One more time again?
In Multnomah County, mm-hmm. there in Oregon, they have a county resolution that allow kids who have been tried as adults to be in their juvenile facilities, and their rate of any sort of incidences within the facilities has actually gone down since that introduction in 2008.
All right, Multnomah County, Portland. Go ahead, Shannon.
Yeah, one thing to note on that, too, the Oregon Youth Authority did a study a few years ago at just the risk levels, like to commit a new crime of their entire population, which includes some of these youth tried as adults. Actually, half their population is youth tried as adults, and then they're what they call juvenile commits who come through the regular juvenile system. And those youth tried as adults were actually overall at lower risk to reoffend than the juvenile commits, and I think part of that is, and they don't know this for sure, but they think the reason they're scoring that way is because, you know, Measure 11 is a kind of one strike and you're outlaw, right? And so these are kids who've made bad choices and potentially committed some harm, but they're not kids necessarily who've been in and out of the system a lot, which is more likely to be the case with the juvenile population. So the risk that these youth pose actually isn't necessarily directly related to the crime they were convicted of.
Let us take a call from Jeannie in Medford. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about juveniles in the adult prison system with Shannon White and Carmen Daugherty.
Hello, hello. Gosh, I got locked up so many times as a little kid in my crime, running away from home. And by the time I hit 12, they said, no, no more juvenile hall. You're going to a convent. Oh, Lord. Anyway, a great experience. I learned to play piano and sew and...
At the convent, you mean?
Languages. But my point being, my crime was running away from home. No one bothered to ever ask me, are things that bad at home that you run away? And that feeling of being locked up as a kid so many times. Oh, yeah, I graduated, you know, receiving homes. I learned to scale those fences, run away from the places that lock you up for running away.
Huh.
Comments, please, and yeah. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call, Jeannie. Appreciate it.
Sure. So at the federal level, I mean, a lot has changed since basically, you know, 1970s. We have the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, and one of the core requirements there is something they call the deinstitutionalization of status offenders, and a runaway would fall into that category, so as would like a truancy issue. And basically, the federal regulations say you can't lock up these kids for these sort of status offenses where adults couldn't be locked up. So that's, you know, that's one positive, another reform effort that has happened over the last few decades.
Well, I have to ask then, Carmen, if the overarching goal here, and I guess this is for both of you too, is if what you're advocating here is that there needs to be more consideration of each individual case. You consider each criminal case committed by a juvenile or allegedly committed by a juvenile on a case-by-case basis more than the rubber stamping that tends to happen with adult offenses. Carmen, start with you.
Sure, absolutely right. We did some polling a few years ago, and the public said they would prefer and they recommend that every case gets an individualized look from a judge. They think judges are the best person to make that decision, and a juvenile judge would be the best decision maker on a case-by-case basis.
And Shannon?
We have done similar polling, Oregon-based polling, and it shows that Oregonians as well want to put judges back into the process, particularly when it comes to the automatic transfer of youth. And, you know, this, as you may have noticed in the trends reports, like our success in changing these laws has been around where youth are held in custody. We have not had success on actually changing that automatic transfer law, but have worked hard for it. It was part of a major public safety reform effort that happened in Oregon during the 2013 legislative session, and ultimately, and tragically, the youth justice reforms were stripped out. But I think in acknowledgement of the fact that Oregon is really on the wrong track and out of sync with what we know works best for youth, out of that bill that passed, it was House Bill 3194, there's a governor's task force, and there's only two things that task force is doing. One, you know, sort of overview of the implementation of the whole bill, and the other thing is to look at this issue of youth who get tried as adults. It is a pressing issue for Oregon, and unfortunately, because it was a ballot measure and it's just become a politically charged issue, the sort of politics around it have prevented there from being real reforms on the kind of core, the heart of this issue, which is that automatic transfer law, and we are hopeful that it will move forward. As I mentioned, we did a report 2 years ago with the Campaign for Youth Justice called Misguided Measures. That's the only comprehensive overview of how youth are tried as adults in Oregon, what the impact has been. And it's devastating, and it is past time for us to enact the kind of transfer laws that some of these other states have enacted to change the way we treat youth as adults in Oregon.
So excellent point to bring up, though, about the lack of judge discretion in cases. So under Measure 11, it really is, no matter what your age, if you commit this crime, you will do this time.
Yeah, for 15, 16, and 17-year-olds, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's really the prosecutor gets to decide. And that's just not the way our justice system is set up. It's an adversarial system. You're supposed to have a prosecutor and a defense lawyer and a judge that come together to come to a resolution, and that's been taken out of the process by our automatic transfer law, Measure 11.
Back to Carmen Daugherty, then, of the Campaign for Youth Justice. I have to believe that mandatory sentencing measures were quite popular across the country at one time. Are a lot of them still in place?
There are quite a few in place. I don't have the exact number of that, but any, you know, in these because these kids are considered adults, I mean, they get the same sentencing as adults in these states. And that has to change. Like, California has definitely taken the lead as far as the post-Miller legislation and using that as the base of changing other laws around their mandatory minimum sentencing.
Okay, running short on time here. Let's take a call from Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Carmen Daugherty and Shannon White.
Yes, very quickly. What's the increase in Oregon, Northern California, of young female offenders that fall into this? Because everybody has a vision of young guys in groups and whatever. I am very curious because of the financing, the separation of facilities and everything.
All right, about female offenders. Thanks for the question, Jim. Shannon, you want to take that on for Oregon?
Yeah, we don't have a huge, we have a relatively small number of youth who are serving at least an adult prison sentence, for that have been mandatory transferred, and I don't have the exact numbers, but it's much smaller, although, you know, I think as the woman caller pointed out before, a lot of times girls are clearly being caught up in situations that are bigger than them, which is what you often find is true, whether they're with, like, adult, older boyfriends that actually get them into situations where they end up prosecuted for these more serious offenses. And that's somewhat anecdotally, having met a bunch of these young girls who are incarcerated in our one juvenile youth facility at Oak Creek. And they follow, I think, a national, you know, trend in research that often youth are, I think this woman was alluding to who called, that are experiencing something at home that gets them out onto the street. They get caught up in bigger things and then end up in our justice system.
Carmen Daugherty, almost out of time. Is the trend still shifting? Is there a momentum building here, do you think?
Absolutely. As we move into this next legislative session, we're seeing more states develop task force to examine their transfer laws and see how kids are entering the system. We're seeing more states take kind of a look back at the implementation of laws passed in the last decade to see how it is affecting public dollars and public safety. So I think this will continue to build.
Carmen Daugherty is at the Campaign for Youth Justice as policy director. She wrote the report, State Trends, Legislative Victories from 2011 to 2013, Removing Youth from the Adult Criminal Justice System. Shannon White is deputy director of the Partnership for Safety and Justice based in Oregon. Thank you both for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you.
You bet. Good to have you both. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk about Halloween celebrations in the region. We'll talk about high-speed rail plans in California. And we'll talk to the author of the book, The Grim Conclusion, some grim fairy tales updated for the current day, tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our production assistant, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.